The interview was recorded several days ago when doctors at Research Hospital indicated it was unlikely that Mr. Truman would recover. Those three men will return to talk more about the former president who was their friend. But first, Harry Reasoner recalls some of the most significant things about Harry Truman, the Missouri farm boy who became the 33rd president of the United States.
It's difficult to recall any time in our history when any man assumed greater responsibility than Harry Truman did during the crucial first months of his presidency. He guided World War II to a close on both fronts. He faced and took on the complexities of bringing about a hard-won peace. The international business of state was a full-time job, but he could not overlook or slight the many problems that faced him here at home. Even within his own party, his battles were hard-fought and hard-won. He constantly tangled with the Congress and once called his Senate and House the worst in the history of the nation. Truman was a courageous man. He made decisions that no man had ever made before. He dealt with crises that were new to the entire world. Truman's stature grew with the trauma of the times. And yet somehow, Harry Truman is remembered with simple affection rather than with awe. He had dreams and plans. He was a born fighter, the individual in the classic tradition who wanted to love and understand his country, its people, his job. Harry Truman was born on May 8, 1884, at Lamar, Missouri. Home circumstances were modest. His parents were of Scotch, Irish, and Dutch descent. He once said, "If you shook the family tree, anything might fall out." His boyhood was spent in the rolling Missouri farm country around Grandview and Independence. He was a bit of a loner, even shy. He spent his time practicing the piano and reading books. National Guard Lieutenant Truman started as an errand boy. The war came, and in spite of the weak eyesight that kept him out of West Point, Truman was accepted by the Army. He was Captain Harry Truman now. Back home after the war, he and an Army buddy went into the men's clothing business in Kansas City. They failed. But master politician Tom Pendergast took Harry Truman under his wing. Truman liked politics, and in time Pendergast put him on the court and helped him become elected as a presiding judge. The childhood sweetheart who had become his wife, Bess Wallace Truman, encouraged his political career. He ran for senator in 1934, and he won. The Truman family moved to Washington, where they were destined to stay for a long time. As head of the Congressional Committee to supervise war contracts and war spending, he became a force in the Senate and in the affairs of a nation at war. It was the fourth and last inauguration of President Roosevelt.
We Americans today, together with our allies, are passing through a period of supreme test. It is a test of our courage, of our resolve, of our wisdom, of our essential democracy.
Harry Truman would not remain vice president for long. The president's health was failing. World War II was drawing to a close. Decisions in its final phases had to be made with increasing and sometimes agonizing frequency. Beyond the immediate problems of military campaigning in two hemispheres, there was the biggest problem of all, the disposition of the territories and the people in those territories after an Allied victory. President Roosevelt was now close to death, and the day of responsibility for Harry Truman was imminent. When Franklin Roosevelt died, Harry Truman was sworn into the presidency in a simple ceremony. He asked the nation, "Pray for me." On April 14, 1945, in the afternoon, the nation said its last goodbye to Franklin Roosevelt, and the toughest job in the land was passed on to Harry Truman, an end and a beginning. On April 16th, the 33rd President of the United States addressed the Congress, in which he had served for 10 years.
It is with a heavy heart that I stand before you, my friends and colleagues, in the Congress of the United States. Tragic fate has thrust upon us grave responsibility. we must carry on. With great humility, I call upon all Americans to help me keep our nation united in defense of those ideals which have been so eloquently proclaimed by Franklin Roosevelt.
Now the Germans were defeated. Their generals came to the armistice table, terms of surrender unconditional. At Potsdam, Winston Churchill, Joseph Stalin, and delegations of Allied officers and diplomats greeted President Truman. The results of the meeting foreshadowed the post-war division of Europe. The wartime alliance was breaking apart. Churchill had long been fearful of Soviet ambition. Stalin had already begun to subvert agreements reached earlier in Yalta. Potsdam was the very beginning of what was to become known as the Cold War. Actual war still raged in the Pacific. Americans suffered heavy casualties as the fighting moved toward Japan. If the Japanese were losing, they showed no inclination to surrender. Truman had been told of the development of the atomic bomb and finally reached the decision that it must be used.
The bombs were dropped after Japan had been warned that we had discovered the greatest explosive in the history of the world, and then we asked them to surrender. They did not do it. We expected to land in Japan with a million men. 250,000 of them, it was estimated, would have been killed, and 500,000 of them would have been maimed for life, and that many Japanese would have been hurt. After the Japanese refused, in language that is not diplomatic, that the offer that I made them to surrender with unconditionally, we dropped the bombs, and they surrendered in a very short time after that. I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government in reply to the message forwarded to that government by the Secretary of State on August 11th. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender.
You'd have to be over 30 to remember where you were on VJ Day. It seemed that the world's troubles had finally ended. If anyone cared to look beyond the confetti and the kisses, this was, again, an end and a beginning. The post-war problems were already being born. This time, the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay was the site for another unconditional surrender. A forlorn foreign minister, Shigemitsu of Japan, limped aboard the Missouri in his country's hour of abject submission. It had been a little less than 4 years since the bombing of Pearl Harbor, although Japanese aggression had begun 13 years before in China. For General Douglas MacArthur, it was the supreme point of his career. General MacArthur was to govern Japan for a while like a constitutional monarch. All too soon, another crisis. American arms were sent to Greece, which was now threatened by a communist-inspired civil war. Planes from aircraft carriers, big guns, rifles, sidearms, material Greek loyalists needed immediately. This aid was sent under the auspices of what was to become known as the Truman Doctrine, designed to avoid the spread of communism. The Greek rebels were defeated, and the Truman Doctrine was implemented by a program of economic aid, inspired by General George Marshall, with Truman's enthusiastic support. President Truman cited General Marshall's foreight as Secretary of State.
Foreign aid is perhaps the greatest venture in constructive statesmanship that any nation has undertaken. It is an outstanding example of cooperative endeavor for the common good. This measure is America's answer to the challenge facing
the free world today. It is a measure of reconstruction, stability, and peace. Its purpose is to assist in the preservation of conditions under which free institutions can survive in the world.
When it seemed their aims for Europe were thwarted by the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan, the Soviets blockaded Berlin. They surrounded the city, cutting off highway and rail traffic from the west. The idea was to starve the population into submission. It almost worked. But the Allies responded with an airlift. For 327 days, the United States and Britain supplied the Berlin sectors with food and supplies. Every necessity of life arrived by airplane. A metropolis was maintained by air alone. At home, the president faced another problem, inflation.
Today, inflation stands as an ominous threat to the prosperity we have achieved. We can no longer treat inflation with spiraling prices and living costs as some vague condition we may encounter in the future. The harsh effects of price inflation are clear. They are felt by wage earners, farmers, and businessmen. Wage earners are finding that bigger paychecks this year buy less than smaller paychecks bought last year.
Then came labor unrest. Harry Truman used federal power to seize the steel mills when the workers went on strike. The move was without precedent. Senator Taft and Representative Hartley got their labor bill through Congress, but the president, even after his brush with the unions, was convinced its passage would be a grave error.
I vetoed the Taft-Hartley bill because I'm convinced it is a bad bill. It is bad for labor, bad for management, bad for the country. It would take bargaining power away from the workers and give more power to management. If we weaken our system of collective bargaining, we weaken the position of every working man in the country.
The bill was passed over his veto, but there were other concerns. Harry Truman actively pressed for civil rights. His legislation was strongly opposed.
Our immediate task is to remove the last remnants of the barriers which stand between millions of our citizens and their birthright. There is no justifiable reason for discrimination because of ancestry or religion or race or color. Many of our people still suffer the indignity of insult, the harrowing fear of intimidation, and I regret to say, the threat of physical injury and mob violence. There is much that state and local governments can do in providing positive safeguards for civil rights, but we cannot any longer await the growth of a will to action in the slowest state or the most backward community.
In 1948, the Democratic National Convention met to nominate Harry Truman for four more years in the White House. The president was in fighting form when he accepted.
Accept the nomination. Senator Barkley and I will win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that.
Truman had selected Senator Alvin Barkley of Kentucky as his running mate. Some thought this was meant as a reward for Barkley's long years of loyalty. Some party members, not too impressed with the team and worried about Truman's prospects, thought it was simply a nice gesture to Mr. Barkley. Let him enjoy the limelight. Governor Thomas E. Dewey of New York was expected to gain by Truman's supposed unpopularity. Dewey, the experts and the pollsters said, was a certain winner, a shoe-in. Truman seemed unaffected by the gloomy prospect. The president began a whistle-stop campaign, undoubtedly the last of the long campaign train rides any president would take, through the farmlands and the metropolitan centers of the country. There were the motorcades and the crowds. He was, after all, the president. The pollsters were wrong this time, and there was a grinning Truman and that famous headline. And he had a few words for a radio commentator who had predicted a Dewey victory.
I had my sandwich and glass of buttermilk and went to bed at 6:30. about 12 o'clock, I happened to wake up for some reason, and the radio was turned on, and Mr. Kelton Barn was saying, "Well, the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote. We have yet to hear." And we are very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by an overwhelming majority. And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
The inauguration in January of 1949 was a lot different from the hasty swearing-in after Roosevelt's death. The platform was packed with well-wishers. Chief Justice Fred Vinson administered the oath.
"Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God."
It was his day, but amid the congratulations and celebrations of the inauguration, Mr. Truman was aware that his responsibilities still loomed large. The next 4 years could be critical in the Cold War. He called for greater effort to achieve international harmony.
"More nations come to know the benefits of democracy and to participate in growing abundance, I believe that those countries which now oppose us will abandon their delusion and join with the free nations of the world in a just settlement of international differences."
It was a great parade, and Harry Truman loved a parade. A day of pleasant splendor and fine pageantry. About as fine a parade as was ever given to a new president. Throughout his presidency, Harry Truman liked to relax in an informal way. His favorite spot was Key West. Private pools there were fine, but there was nothing wrong with the water in the bay or with the spirit of the moment. Welcome to the club. In the spring of 1949, the agreement establishing the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was signed in Washington. The creation of NATO was another step by the Western Allies to contain Soviet expansion. Truman spoke for the aims of the alliance.
"There are those who claim that this treaty is an aggressive act on the part of the nations which ring the North Atlantic. That is absolutely untrue. Men with courage and vision can still determine their own destinies. They can choose slavery or freedom, war or peace. I have no doubt which they will choose. The treaty we are signing here today is evidence of the path they will follow. If there is anything certain today, if there is anything inevitable in the future, it is the will of the people of the world for freedom and for peace."
1950, war in Korea. Truman, acting for the UN, sent troops on their first collective mission.
"To make the decision that sent American boys again into battle. I was a soldier in the First World War, and I know what a soldier goes through. I know well the anguish that mothers and fathers and families go through. In Korea, our men are fighting as valiantly as Americans have ever fought, because they know they are fighting in the same cause of freedom in which Americans have stood ever since the beginning of this republic. Where free men have failed the test before, this time we met the test."
Harry Truman had never met Douglas MacArthur, who was directing the war in Korea. The general had not been back to the United States for 14 years. So the president flew to Wake Island in the Pacific, a trip he made so that MacArthur could stay close to his critical post. It was a friendly meeting. The two men seemed to agree on the conduct of the war in Korea. But as the war continued, it became apparent that they were growing further apart. MacArthur campaigned for a direct attack on war bases in communist China. Truman considered this more than simply indiscreet. MacArthur's views, the president said, were directly opposed to the policy of the United States and her allies. On April 11, 1951, President Truman fired General MacArthur. The move was swift. Truman showed no wish for compromise in dismissing the general. He exercised his constitutional power as the commander-in-chief. and he explained his seemingly sudden decision in an address to the nation.
I believe that we must try to limit the war to Korea for these vital reasons, to make sure that the precious lives of our fighting men are not wasted, to see that the security of our country and the free world is not needlessly jeopardized, and to prevent a third world war. A number of events have made it evident that General MacArthur did not agree with that policy. I have therefore considered it essential to relieve General MacArthur so that there would be no doubt or confusion as to the real purpose and aim of our policy. It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders. But the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual.
General MacArthur came home. He was the man of the hour. His entourage met wild and enthusiastic crowds. Now it was the time of the general. He was invited to speak before a joint session of Congress.
I have constantly called for the new political decisions essential to a solution. Efforts have been made to distort my position. It has been said, in effect, that I was a warmonger. Nothing could be further from the truth.
In March of 1952, President Truman attended the annual Jefferson-Jackson dinner in Washington. Democratic leaders were in a festive mood, although again there were signs of discontent. No one was quite prepared for what Harry Truman had to say that night.
I shall not be a candidate for re-election. I have served my country long and I think efficiently and honestly. I shall not accept a renomination. I do not feel that it is my duty to spend another 4 years in the White House.
The Democratic National Convention met with no idea who the nominee would be. Averell Harriman was the candidate originally favored by Mr. Truman. But the convention swung to Adlai Stevenson, and the president, loyal to the party, became Stevenson's supporter.
I ask of you all you have. I will give you all I have. Even as he who came here tonight and honored me, as he has honored you, the Democratic Party, by a lifetime of service and bravery that will find him an imperishable page in the history of the Republic, and of the Democratic Party, President Harry S. Truman.
The Republicans gave their nomination to the man to whom Truman once offered the Democratic nomination, General Eisenhower. The time had come for the Trumans to move out of the White House after a stay of nearly 8 years. The White House always seems to take on some of the personality of the tenant, and because it had been home, it was in some respects hard to go. As in any move from house to house, there was the packing and all the goodbyes.
So as I enter the drawers of this desk, and as Mrs. Truman and I leave the White House, we have no regrets. We feel we have done our best in the public service. I hope and believe we have contributed to the welfare of the nation and to the peace of the world. And now the time has come for me to say good night and God bless you.
Back in Independence, Harry Truman settled down to the role of a private citizen. He liked to say he had now joined the army of the unemployed. In retirement, he still liked to take his morning walks. And for a while, it was just the way it was in Washington or New York. He was accompanied by a phalanx of reporters. He was still quick with a quip, never at a loss for a cogent reply when a reporter asked a question.
Truman,
any question.
Where's the blame for the lag in our missile program today?
Because it wasn't carried through after I left the White House. We had the thing set up and they let it go to pop. That's the reason.
The style, the quick and honest pickup in any verbal go-around was strictly Harry Truman. Even when he visited President Johnson at the White House, he pulled no punches.
What do you think President Johnson's going to choose as his running mate?
Ask him.
That's a good answer.
That's an answer to you.
It is indeed.
The only man in the country can select a vice president is the president himself. Did you know that? Yes. I selected mine.
Yes, see you did. Do you think you did select yours a little earlier, though, didn't you? Or at least give hints or indications?
No.
What did you come to tell the president today?
I didn't come to tell him a darn thing. He's probably got something to tell me.
Did you come to make some suggestions about
his
protection?
I never tell the president what he ought to do. I sincerely hope he'll protect himself. That I'm in favor of 100%.
Do you think he's been a little bit careless?
I don't know.
Do you think he's doing maybe too much traveling or too much...
No, the president can go where he pleases, when he pleases, and he ought to have a right to do it, and he does, and he can't do anything about it. Just bear that in mind.
But I remember you used to like to sneak away from the Secret Service.
I never did run off from the Secret Service. You can't run off from them. What are you talking about? They're too efficient.
Mr. Truman toured Europe in 1956, visiting the countries which had benefited from the Marshall Plan. He visited Britain and received an honorary degree at Oxford. Pretty good for a high school graduate from Missouri. Then on to Paris, just to see the sights, he said. But he wasn't just Mr. Truman, private citizen, and he performed a traditional duty for visiting dignitaries, laying a wreath on the tomb of the unknown warrior. As much as he might want to be the man from Independence, to the world he was still President Truman. His dream was the Truman Library in Independence. Before the library was built, he talked about its purpose while sitting for a sculptor.
It'll contain the presidential papers. There are about 3,500,000 of them. That runs to some 39 tons. And it will contain all the correspondence and all the documents on which the orders and decisions were made during my administration. And they'll be available. It is my opinion that the papers of the president should be available for scholars and that they should be indexed and made available so they can be used. Now, there are 16 sets of presidential papers piled up in the Library of Congress. They've never been indexed. They've never been placed in a position where they are safe for the simple reason that anybody can go in there and take a look at them. And here not long ago, some fellow went in there and walked off with a paper and went down on the street and sold it. $300, but those things ought to belong to the government and be available for the use of scholars and people who are interested in the history of the United States.
I had the privilege of meeting your wonderful family, Mrs. Truman, and your daughter yesterday. I was very much surprised at how much she looked like you.
Well, that's too bad. I always thought she looked like her mother.
Now she looks like you.
All the good qualities she got from her mother.
I wonder what some of your observations are in these past 75 years.
Well, I've had a rather hectic life and a very happy one. And I've always done the best I possibly can in everything I've tried to undertake.
Mr. Truman, if you had to live your life over again, would there be anything that you'd change?
I don't think so. I think one of the changes would be I'd get married sooner.
It was Harry Truman's 80th birthday, 1964. Lyndon Johnson presented him with the first Medicare card at the National Press Club in Washington.
Always ended up with you're getting the best of it and doing what you pleased anyway. You didn't give a damn what I thought, my lord. But it's been a most pleasant experience. And the very fact that you're doing what you do here today shows that you have some respect for the old man who has spent 80 years on this planet, who has spent 30 or 40 years in politics, and has had every experience in politics, you might say, from precinct to president. And it's a program that an old, worn-out politician is not used to, as I told you. If you'd commence finding fault, give me a chance to throw a brick at you once in a while, I'd feel a lot better about it. But then my wife said that I've thrown enough bricks and it's about time for me to begin to make a few friends. Well, looks like I've got them.
We'd like to talk more about Harry Truman now with the man who knew him. Several days ago, when doctors at Research Hospital indicated it was unlikely that former President Truman would recover, we invited three such men to our studio to share some of their memories with us. The three are Associate Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, who in 1948 was President Truman's first choice to be his running mate. Arthur Kroc, the retired Washington bureau chief for the New York Times, and Washington lawyer Paul Porter, a man who served President Truman in many capacities while he was chief executive.
Would you have guessed when President Truman succeeded President Roosevelt that he would measure up to the job of being an outstanding president?
I didn't know. I knew him as a senator. I liked him very much. I saw a lot of him and his colleagues on the so-called Truman Committee that went around the country.
Were you on the Supreme Court then?
Yes, looking at the defense plants, seeing how they were doing and so on. Two of those members became members of the court by Truman appointment. One was Harold Burton and the other was Sherman Minton. And that was a very careful, detailed, conscientious job that he did as a senator. I used to see him socially. He had a very keen sense of humor that was a sort of a countryman's sense of humor that you don't talk much about in parlors and on TV. But it was robust and healthy. It was American. But he was unknown in the perspective of the presidency, and it was a matter of his development and growth as the years passed.
Mm-hmm. Did it surprise you,
Mr. No, I don't. Not really. For two reasons. I think it was. Well, he was still a senator, and it must have been in about 22. That Charles Ross, who later became his secretary, press secretary, was then the correspondent of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, asked me to invite a few top correspondents to meet Senator Truman, who was then engaged in his job as head of the committee overseeing the war. And he made a very good impression then, particularly because it was obvious from the way he answered questions that he was not approaching this in a partisan way at all. It was the most nonpartisan response, considering who he was and the fact that Roosevelt was president and a very formidable figure to criticize.
Well, Howard, my first vivid impression of President Truman, I think, came during the 1944 campaign. And you recall that President Roosevelt was busy engaged in the prosecution of the war. He left a great deal of the campaigning to his vice presidential nominee, Mr. Truman. Well, Mr. Truman came to New York City one night to appear at a rally at Madison Square Garden. And his speech had been prepared for his scrutiny and his revision. And one member of his staff looked at this thing. We were having a meeting on this. And he exclaimed in horror. Well, this is trying to out-Wallace Henry Wallace. Truman said, I'm glad you get the idea. That is the purpose and effort of this rally at Madison Square Garden. And I'd like to add one other thing. When he became president, I think one of the things that impressed me most was his reverence, almost a theological or religious reverence of all of the office of the presidency. And he would no more think of an act or a course of conduct which in his judgment might in any sense demean that office than he would perhaps of criticizing Margaret's musical ability.
Yes. Now, we talked about some of the decisions he made. He once said he thought the greatest test he faced was going to fight in Korea without making up his mind in a short time without anybody backing him. Do you think that that was his greatest test, or if not, what do you consider a greater test?
Well, he had quite a few. I agree with Arthur Kroc that the decision to drop the bomb was probably the most critical. I've said before publicly that I would not have done it and I think we paid it an awful price for doing it. But those were, that's for the benefit of hindsight, and the man who has to make the decision has to make the decision in the best of his lights, and there was nothing malicious in Harry Truman. He was acting to the best interest, as he saw it at that time, of America and its people. Some thought that the, I remember Bob Patterson, who was Secretary of the Army, I believe, he was a federal judge in New York and left the bench to come into the cabinet during the war. He thought that the greatest thing that Truman did was to announce what Paul Porter had just talked about on the Truman Doctrine.
That sure was a big break with past foreign policy.
It was a big break. But the Truman Doctrine, you see, has been greatly misunderstood and greatly distorted. I say that with some personal knowledge because in the summer of which Paul Porter speaks, I spent in Greece. And the head of the military mission that we had there was General Van Fleet, who was an old friend of mine and whom I greatly admired. And I also knew the head of the Greek army, Papagos, who was a great traditionalist in the military sense. And what we did, what the Americans did, was to provide not only money, but also a military mission to train the Greek army. We didn't have an expeditionary force there. We didn't have a Vietnam situation. We didn't approach it that way. We merely had a military mission. That was the Truman Doctrine. And since then, it's become, in popular minds, something that justifies American invasion, American paratroopers anywhere in the world to fight communism. That wasn't Harry Truman's idea. It was merely to make strong the local forces so that they could fight.
Well, I know, Mr. Smith, we're all these days really preoccupied with foreign policy considerations. And I would like, if I may, to comment on another characteristic of President Truman. And that is, he would not tolerate, under any circumstances, any interference by his staff or anyone in the executive with the independent administrative agencies. And I attended a staff meeting at the White House on one occasion where I was chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. When he laid down the law and order to his staff to hands off of any pressure, any ex parte representations, or anything of that sort to these quasi-judicial agencies. And he put it in such terms that only a mule skinner from a Missouri Cavalry Brigade could do. But he was not ambiguous when he meant. That is a lesson I think could be learned today.
Clinton Rossiter, in his book about American presidents, says, as a technician, Truman was a very good president. He knew how to delegate work. He knew how to divide his time among his many chores, and he was almost ideal, even if he did make a few bad appointments. Do you think he was a good technical president?
I think thanks to Clark Clifford, who did a lot of the paperwork, he was at that level.
Yeah.
I don't think by background and experience, he had the professional training that would go into that, but he had common sense, he had good judgment and balance, but he had the staff, and I think it was Clark who rescued it from
disorganization. I would like to associate myself with Justice Douglas's comment on that, and I've said often, I would repeat here, that while Truman had this inherent, innate, great ability, great qualities of leadership, I think two individuals that contributed as much to his posture, Clark Clifford and Dean Acheson.
Now, he was, he's now considered by history to have been one of the near great presidents. In your newspaper, the New York Times, 80 historians voted on how the presidents rated, and he rated way up near the top. Yet, even after his experience as a senator, he didn't do very well with Congress. He had to veto bill after bill, and he was in eternal fights with them.
We were in an emerging state of conflict between the executive and the legislature.
Yeah.
That's been repeated throughout American history. These periods recur. One is on top of the other. Happens very frequently. And he happened to come along at a time when this conflict was maturing again. And that, I think, accounts for his difficulties.
Mr. Kroc, you'll recall that in the 1948 campaign, he called the turnip session of Congress, he calls it.
Yes.
Called them back into special session to enact a new price control bill. And he got me from the private sector to go up as a special representative and present this to Congress. Well, now, that didn't get him off on an auspicious start with the relationships with the Congress, because they felt they were being used as a political pawn in a political campaign. And perhaps they were.
And it worked?
Of course they were.
It worked, apparently.
Yes, it worked.
But I think as far as technical administrative record is concerned, that President Truman, his administration, was often as confused as Nixon's or Johnson's, or in comparison with Eisenhower's, which was a very smooth operation indeed. This, to my mind, Truman's was smoother than Roosevelt's or Nixon's or Kennedy's or Johnson's, but it was not really a triumph of technical coherence, I don't think. I recall many times when the administration spoke with several voices. It was awfully difficult to know who was really speaking for the president, who wasn't.
He was very...
Mr. Kroc, I might observe that once we get management and efficiency and Harvard Business School techniques in the White House, a precious ingredient of our democracy, may have been lost.
Well, that may be true. I was thinking only of the subject of the technical administration.
Yes.
One voice becomes just one voice, and America is a...
Yes, well, that was the
many voices.
Now, President Truman was proud of the fact that though he had never gone to college, I think the only president in this century who never went to college, he self-educated himself in history. Do you believe he had a sense of history?
I don't think he knew very much about the world when he came into the White House. I think he learned a lot about it. He was eager to learn. I'd go over, in those days I traveled a lot in the summer, and I'd go over and report. I'd say, Mr. President, I'm going abroad at my own expense, not at the taxpayer's expense. Is there anything I can do for you? He said, where are you going? And I'd tell him the countries, and then he'd give me little assignments. He said, find out about this, find out about that, and come back. And he didn't very often follow my advice, but I gave him full reports.
Well, Mr. Justice, I'd like to make this comment on the question of his homework and his preparation. The last assignment I had from President Truman was to succeed Ralph Bunche and Mark Etheridge as the head of the UN Palestine Conciliation Commission. I went on to say my farewells to him. And he opened his desk drawer and he took out a map of Palestine. And I was amazed. He had doodled all over that map. And he said, Paul, I'm not telling you what to do or what this United Nations mission should do, but here are my ideas. And he knew about boundaries, the headwaters of the Jordan, the Gulf of Aqaba, the Negev, the refugee camps, the Golan Heights. And I was amazed at the wealth of detail that he spent the time doing this personally.
Well, he was the first to recognize the state of Israel.
That's right. Yes, he once told me, Mr. Judge, I think I'm the best friend that the Jews have ever had since Moses. I said, Mr. President, that's true, so I'm not going to say that. Somebody else will.
I think we ought to have a little more to say about the human side of Harry Truman. And I had a couple of experiences that illustrate that, if I may.
Please.
He gave me, as you said, an exclusive interview in the year 1950. And after he was president, after he retired as president, He came before a Senate committee, and he was questioned on one statement in that interview, which was that a condition of 4 to 5 million unemployed was tolerable, which now would mean 6 or 7 or 8. And questioned about that, he said he had never said any such thing, and moreover, he'd never granted the interview. So I've kept a very careful record of all this, and I cited chapter and verse. And what did he do? He publicly retracted his denial, said that everything I had said was true, and then I wrote him a letter telling him it was one of the most painful things ever happened to me to have to contradict him on the basis I had. And I got the most affectionate and charming and flattering letter in return that I've ever got from anybody.
That's Harry Truman.
Magnificent, magnanimous man.
I would get, I've written, by the way, my autobiography, and a lot of this is in there. The letters and letters that he wrote me just excoriating me more than Arthur Kroc ever dreamed
about. About what general subjects?
I forget something in the public domain, of course, in the international law or...
Suspensions you had made.
Well, perhaps...
But not rulings from the court.
Not rulings from the court. Or perhaps an article or a book or whatnot. Just written longhand, you know, just... You just see him doing it. Just all this power coming through the pen. And then in a couple of days would come a telephone call or a little message saying the president wants to see you. And so I'd go over and walk in, be at the Oval Office alone. He'd walk across, put his arms around me. Sometimes there'd be tears in his eyes. He'd say, Bill, he said, I shouldn't have written that letter. I apologize.
Well,
will you forgive me? I said, sure. Nothing to forgive. This is part of living.
I mean, some of his statements reflect great humility, and others reflect great pride and come close to arrogance. How did those two mix? Was he a humble man or not? I recall statements whereby he said, 1 million people could do this president job better than I, but I've got the job and I'm doing it. I recall others in which he said, can you tell us how American foreign policy is made? He said, I make American foreign policy.
Well, that was simply because he was always, Paul Porter spoke of it, I think, his reverence for the office. He wanted everybody to understand that the office was paramount, not the man. The man was speaking in the first instance. The president was speaking in the second instance.
Precisely.
He was a plain man, but not a humble man at all.
Arthur's point might be illustrated by a little episode. Truman, during the Korean War, ordered the army to take over the steel plants because of some strike problem and so on. And it came to court, and our court held 6-3 that Truman had acted unconstitutionally. That there was no law, and only Congress had the power to pass a law of that kind, or any law. and the dissenters were, as I remember, Fred Vinson, Truman's appointment to the court as Chief Justice, dissented, and a couple of others. One of his appointees, Tom Clark, was with the majority of us. Well, a few weeks passed, and Hugo Black sent word around that he had talked to the White House, and Truman had agreed to come out to Black's garden in Alexandria, Virginia, for a stag dinner, and we were all invited. So there comes Harry, Harry Truman, you know. He'd been, here's the court that plowed him under, did him in, and so on. And everybody, of course, was happy and relaxed and kidding him about it, and he was kidding back. He never gave up. He said, you're all wrong, but by golly, he says, your food is good. That's Harry Truman.
Howard, I think I essentially agree with what Justice Douglas and Arthur Kroc have said. He was an humble man, but a proud man. And the office of the presidency, you could go just so far, but not beyond that. That barrier was there. He didn't have to announce it, didn't have to proclaim it. He just exuded the aura of command when he was being president.
Only two other presidents in American history lived longer than Truman's 88 years. They were John Adams and Herbert Hoover, who lived till the age of 90. Only four other presidents lived longer in retirement, in Truman's case, 20 years, getting near to 21 years as a former president. Not many presidents entered the presidency at a more advanced age than Truman. He was 60 when he was called to the White House and told by Mrs. Franklin Roosevelt, "Harry, the president is dead." He said to her, "Can I do something for you?" And she answered, "It is now you we must do things for." Harry Truman, the only president in this century who did not go to college, will never be famous for his literary output, but future books of famous quotations will run over with things that he said off the cuff with unsurpassed aptness. From that little sign he invented on his desk, "The buck stops here," to his definition of political viability, quote, "If you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen." He was a fount of ad-lib wisdom on man's basic art, the art of politics. Of General Eisenhower's plans for action on becoming president, Truman said, quote, "Poor Ike, he will give an order. Nothing will happen. He won't know why." Nobody ever fathomed the inertia of bureaucracy so expertly in so few words as that. Of the powers of the office of president, he once said, "My main power is to bring people in and try to persuade them to do what they ought to do without being persuaded. That's what I spend my time doing. That's what the powers of the presidency amount to." Yet when an audience was debating the complexities of making foreign policy, Truman stopped it saying, "I make American foreign policy." No president better mixed firmness with humility. He disarmed his critics when he said, quote, "There are probably a million people in this country who could do this president job better than I can, but I've got the job and I'm doing the very best I can." He was right about doing the best he could, but the other part about others being able to do it better, history will doubt that. Good night.
This has been an ABC News special report about Harry Truman. A look at the life of the 33rd President of the United States.